Hi, I'm Virginia State Senator Suhas Subramaniam, and I'm running for the U.S. Congress in Northern Virginia. And you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
My name is Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with talented and interesting individuals linked to the global Indian and South Asian community. It's informal and informative, adding insights to our evolving cultural expressions, where each person can proudly say, "Trust me, I know what I'm doing." Hi, everyone. On this episode of Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing, we share a conversation with Virginia State Senator and congressional candidate Suhas Subramaniam. Stay tuned. So I've been thinking a lot about temperament, especially the temperament that's critically required to govern and lead and successfully navigate the political landscape. It seems like there are so many forces that can draw one away from being focused and dedicated to the tasks at hand. And speaking of required temperament and focused dedication, thank you for listening to the show and for rating and kindly reviewing it and following it on social media. It's very much appreciated and I'm quite grateful. I don't know if you've heard, but it's a busy election year so far, and I can already feel the tone of discussion and dialogue changing to the point where we need reminders about listening and engaging and finding common building blocks instead of retreating into our own tribes. So it was actually terrific to talk to Suhas Subramaniam, someone who is currently governing at the state level and now aiming for national impact. Suhas is a state senator in Virginia and is running now for Congress in Virginia's 10th district. He's a business owner and a dad, a volunteer EMT and firefighter, and he spent his career serving his community and taking on some pretty tough fights. After getting a law degree, Suhas served as a White House technology policy advisor to President Obama, tackling cybersecurity threats and modernizing government agencies. Since 2019, as a Virginia state senator, he's passed legislation to bring down drug and healthcare costs, fought against costly overcharges by utility companies and toll operators, and worked to fully fund schools and mental health services while also combating the rise of gun violence. And his passion for coalition building, staying true to his identity as an Indian American and a Hindu, and simply getting things done, is evident as co-founder of Virginia's first Asian American Pacific Islander Caucus, and as founder of the Commonwealth Caucus, a group of legislators dedicated to building unity and bridging the political divide. Suhas, his wife Miranda, and their young daughters Maya and Nina are in Ashburn, Virginia. And with all of his busy endeavors and commitments and an ongoing campaign for Congress, in meetings and in conversation, I've truly been struck by his calm and engaging temperament. But of course, I also wanted to know more about what keeps him energized. We're chatting on a school night. You've come from a day of working for the people of your district. And you and your wife have two young kids.
Yeah.
Seemingly all things that can take a lot of time and effort and definitely draw your attention. You know, I'm curious, on a day like today, where you've certainly spent a lot of time doing all these things, what tends to energize you? What tends to actually keep you with that momentum to ensure that the work is strong in all fronts, by the way?
Absolutely. You know, I'm a state senator in the Virginia General Assembly right now, and I'm running for the U.S. Congress. And on both fronts, I feel like I'm doing things that, you know, if I weren't here, maybe won't get done. You know, today I passed a really difficult bill on trying to make prescription drug costs more affordable for families across Virginia. And I was also able to help my community fix a local issue when it came to noise coming from the airport. And these were really tough fights. Things that maybe other legislators tend to shy away from sometimes. And it's sort of why I got into this in the first place, is because I want to take on tough fights and I love winning them. And so, you know, my day starts at 6 a.m. and it usually ends at 11 p.m. or midnight. But I don't feel tired, because I feel like when the work gets done, when we get results, when we can help people and their hardest days, that really like drives me, and it's exciting.
Yeah. Has that crossed over into your parenting experience so far too? And hopefully getting lots of wins there as well.
Well, they definitely wear me out, but they're so much fun. Yeah, Maya is 3 and Nina is 2. And, you know, we are very blessed. They are wonderful. We just moved them into the same room, so that's an adventure. But No, it's exciting. One of the things though is I have to be down in Richmond during session, so I don't get to see them as much. So it's
Yeah.
usually weekends and some evenings, but so I miss them a lot during session. But they are what keeps me going too, because their future is what's on the line.
You're running for Congress, obviously, and it's a crowded field of Democrats, and in otherwise a very relatively purple district, which means that most people are really seeking middle ground and looking to find good solutions. And congratulations for helping to spearhead a lot of the stuff you just mentioned. Is there something about this district that you feel sets it as kind of a proxy for what's kind of happening nationally? Especially where, a lot of people are looking for middle ground and they are in that sort of, purplish area of politics or at least what they want from government. So, is your district kind of emblematic of that?
Absolutely. The suburbs is what delivered Joe Biden the election last time. It's what helped Donald Trump in 2016. And we are the suburbs of DC, and we're the purple suburbs. And I always tell people, even though you might see my Senate district may lean quite a bit blue and this congressional district might lean blue, the people here care more about the candidate than they do about the political party most of the time. And I talk to people. I've knocked tens of thousands of doors in this district over the past couple of years. And the one thing I hear is they're tired of the rhetoric of the dysfunction of the divisions, and they like someone like me who works across the aisle, who wants to get things done, who wants to take on tough fights that no one else will. They like that spirit, and they like how accessible I am. And so I've always felt like this is an easy area to represent because my values are similar to the values of the people who live here. They want to see a brighter future for their kids and their families. They want to see safety and from gun violence and improving our access to healthcare and fixing our immigration system. So many things. So I that's right. I think that's right. And I look forward to seeing how I think turnout's going to be really high this year. I actually think that people are paying attention, and we've made it easier than ever to vote in Virginia. So I expect to see a lot of people come out.
And of course, all the while, as you're kind of knocking on doors and again, sort of like this whole adage that politics is local, are you continuing to learn stuff about your district all the time that are sometimes maybe surprising to you? And then does that become additive information to help you not just legislate, but to, also campaign?
Yeah, I think when you're in an elected office, like I am in the state Senate, and you're running for Congress, you have to be talking to people all the time. And so I'm never surprised in the sense that I have so many conversations around our community, different events and town halls that, I learn, I'm always learning. And I think as long as you have that communication, another thing I do is my cell phone number is my office number. So when people call our office, they're calling my cell phone actually, and they're texting it. When we tr we I try to be accessible because it makes me a better legislator, and it makes me feel like I'm not surprised actually when an issue comes up. I know how people would generally feel about it. So yes and no, I do think that being accessible has its benefits.
Again, like being accessible, being relatable, feeling like you have a good pulse on what's going on continually in the district. And then, of course, having that kind of growth mindset of like constantly learning about things. And yet it's, I'm imagining, pretty taxing because while you're running a campaign, you're still charged with representing and governing. In this way, I imagine that being able to govern and having won elections in the past and being able to do the work for the people and kind of represent them, I imagine that it gives you a platform for your record to really showcase. And yet in 2024, when attention spans seem to be so like fleeting for a lot of people, showcasing your platform sometimes becomes a bridge to try and decide between old versus new and people who are just hungry for change, but they're also sometimes have a short-term memory for the institutional things that have happened. Is that weave kind of a delicate one where you especially have to try and garner support for, new voters who may not know your record really well, and then fundraisers who are looking to, embark on change. Have you been able to kind of grapple with some of that?
I actually just I have the same message everywhere I go. I have the same sort of speech as I do at a fundraiser, as I do in a one-on-one conversation. I just hone on kind of the things that I care about, and they seem to be what everyone else cares about, which is I want to make sure our community feels safe. I want to make sure our community is healthy. I want to sure everyone has access to the American dream. That means a good economy, good for small businesses. And I think when you have like this baseline, we also want to look to the future, whether it's addressing our immigration system or the environment. Sometimes you stress one or two issues more in a certain audience, but generally, my message kind of stays the same. I gave the same talk when I met with the NRA this past session. I told them the exact same things I tell people in a Democratic Party meeting. But the difference, I try to at least listen. I also had a pro-life group come in, and they talked about some of their concerns with my position, and I just told them where I came from, but I understood, what their intentions were. And we may not be agree on this, but I think you have to listen to people who may disagree with you, or maybe, but I like to think that consistency and honesty and being authentic is maybe even missing sometimes in politics today. And so when you're like that with every crowd, a lot of people will like it. That's what I found.
Well, and you mentioned consistency and honesty, and I love the fact that you're a deep listener, engaging with people who may not agree with you. All the things you mentioned, right? Safety and economic progress and fighting fights that mean something for people, particularly in the middle class. All the things you mentioned are probably things that a lot of people mention on a day-to-day basis. If you ask just about every politician, they might actually say a lot of the same things that you just did. So, especially when in an era where distrust, sometimes can be a real issue for voters, how do you kind of break through that, right? Because at some point, everybody seems like they're certainly making the same kinds of statements and promises, and yet delivering on those things is a little bit different. How do you separate out grassroots reality from, the same message that seemingly comes from just about everybody in politics?
Yeah, it's pretty simple. I try not to promise what I can't deliver, but I have a great track record of delivering on my promises. So a couple of examples, my big talk when I was campaigning the very first time for the state legislature, I just talked over and over again about how I'm going to pass measures on gun violence prevention that we'd never passed before. And then people told me not to touch this issue of expensive toll roads going through our county. People told me, the pharma had way too big of an influence on our politics, and it'd be difficult to pass anything. And I got things done on all of those issues. I'm sure I can think of things that I've tried to do where it was just hard to do. I think in Congress, we're not getting as much done as we are at the state legislature, so it might be a little harder, certainly. But certainly, what I just try to say is I'm going to try. I'm going to try on every issue. And even if it's just me, just my one vote, my one voice. Sometimes all you need is one voice to be ambitious and optimistic. You can get a lot done. I've seen it happen here, and I've seen it happen. And you don't even need to be a legislator sometimes. But I think you have to at least try, right? You have to at least try. And that's what I always promise people is I will fight, and I will take on the toughest fights, and I've got a track record of winning.
Does that humility, in a way, or I'm even kind of leading with empathy, have you found that that helps in some ways, kind of not just to win people over, but actually like build coalitions that, then allow you to, in fact, make that progress happen?
Yeah, I think people, I'll get bills sent to me because it's me and because they feel like I will put together a coalition. I kind of joke with people now. People actually don't send me the easy ones. They send me the hardest ones because they're like, okay, who's going to carry this bill? Everyone else is saying no, but we'll go to Suhas because Suhas got that last one done and we had no idea it was possible. So yeah, I've gained a reputation for taking on tough fights. And really it's not me. I'm not I certainly I'll to be telling voters I'm special, but the truth is not, it's not that I'm smarter than anyone else or harder working. There's smart, hardworking people. I just feel like you have to start with being ambitious and optimistic and believing that something can get done, and then building the coalition, finding the playbook, finding the hack, whatever you want to call it, and just doing it. And sometimes it'll take a year. Sometimes it'll take, I've got legislation that's passing this year that took 5 years to pass, but people appreciate you trying at least, and people appreciate you listening. That's what I always promise I'll do.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's take a quick break and return to our conversation with congressional candidate Suhas Subramaniam. Stay tuned. Conversation. It's the antidote to apathy and the catalyst for relationships. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hi, this is Vidya Balan, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Hi, I'm Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, and you are listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Welcome back to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation now with congressional candidate Suhas Subramaniam. You know that you speak to, you know, the power of patience there too, right? I mean, because you're sort of like playing the long game, and yet people have expectations that, of course, are incredibly demanding, and you know they want to see results, you know, right away. And yet, you know, you also talk about optimism and making sure that your values and principles are also center and forefront. What is this time in the legislative body and in the Virginia sort of, you know, state legislature? What's that kind of showed you, not just about patience, but in fact about the power of compromise without necessarily changing your values and staying consistent with kind of being who you are?
Yeah, absolutely. I that's a good point. I mean, we have to find ways to get things done. And sometimes people think it's blue team versus red team. But I think the most lasting solutions and lasting results are the ones that are that have a coalition around them, and usually a bipartisan coalition. Because if you pass something that's super partisan and doesn't have the coalition behind it, you know, people are going to spend time trying to tear it down. I remember the Affordable Care Act was something I worked on as a staffer on Capitol Hill. And Republicans have just spent the past 15 years trying to undermine it rather than try to fix it. You know, I think one of those lessons is we should be trying to build a sense of like unity around everything we try to do. Now, I was there. It was difficult because I believe that Republicans weren't willing to do anything. They didn't want anyone to get the win. But, you know, at the same time, even if you're not going to get someone's vote, you can get someone's ideas if they're good ideas. And so you can. Yeah. Even when people vote against my bills, I get for their feedback on how I could make it better and try to fix whatever they think is broken if I think it's good feedback. So I like to build consensus and I like to build coalitions, and it doesn't matter whether it's Democrats or Republicans, progressive or liberal or conservative. The lasting change is the ones that have coalitions and consensus around them.
Why do you think that is, that people gravitate towards the edges of either being black or white, or it's a this or that kind of choice, as opposed to seeking the grays? You know, you mentioned the Affordable Care Act, right? I mean, like, people have been trying for years to repeal it as opposed to fix it. Is it just simply because it just takes that much more energy? Or is it because, hey, that's what voters gravitate towards, or fund or donors gravitate towards, or that it's just not sexy enough to tout that all or nothing kind of attitude, as opposed to really getting to the middle and finding ways to really sharpen and iterate towards more progress?
It's a good question. I think we tend to gravitate to our different corners of the political spectrum. And it's easy to, when you're on the blue team and the red team does something mean or bad, it's easy to just say, okay, I told you so. And like, why should we ever work with them? Right. And a lot of these primaries are a litmus test in the end of how blue you are, how dedicated you are to the blue team sometimes. And I haven't necessarily taken that path. The path that I've taken and the message I say is I am on the blue team. I've always been on the blue team, but at the same time, I'm the red team has good ideas, I'm good with that too. I'm open to good ideas regardless of where it's coming from. And
is that risky, by the way? As you know, in especially in the climate that we live in,
certainly not in vogue right now. When I started a caucus on bipartisanship, that was not a popular move in my caucus or even in the other caucus. It's cool right now to be attacking the other side. It gets more likes, it gets more shares, it gets more attention, it gets more money when it comes to fundraising. And so I almost see it as part of my job to try to change the paradigm and be the consensus builder, nice guy in the room, whenever I can be. And that's not as exciting sometimes to people, but it's exciting to me when I get things done and I have results to show for it.
Well, and in the end, right? I mean, it's first and foremost, hopefully exciting for you, and hopefully more than anything else, your record is speaking for itself. I appreciate, of course, like many who probably are listening right now, that you're the son of immigrants and certainly have, you know, accomplished quite a bit as a lawyer, former advisor in the Obama White House, and done so much. I can't, by the way, forget that you're a medic and an EMT and a firefighter and have had some deep experiences, you know, there. And how do you blend all of that kind of deep experience with empathy and humility, especially that the kind that's needed to connect with, you know, everyday middle-class Americans in your district?
Yeah, I just see it as, you know, these are just ways to serve. You know, people are asking me, why am I running for Congress? It's like, I can serve our community in such a bigger scale. 80% of the things I get are federal issues, immigration, national security issues, you know, people having trouble with federal contracting. I know all those things. I know I've worked on the Hill. I know how to get things done, but I refer them to my member of Congress because that's what I have to do. And so when I think about how do I speak to the different parts of my community, really, I just start with service and what's going to be best for a community. And to me, that usually ends up, my service has in the, at times it's been as a firefighter and an EMT, times it's been in the state Senate doing what I do. And I think now the time right now is for me to be in Washington, because I see a lot of people frustrated with Washington. So I just go where I feel like I'm needed and where I can serve best.
And we mentioned the, you know, the fact that your parents immigrated here. When it comes to your identity, your cultural background, your religious background, how do you think this contributes in 2024 to American patriotism?
You know, when I first was elected, I was the first Indian American elected in Virginia, the first South Asian, first Hindu American. And, you know, I saw myself not as someone running as an Indian American and Hindu American. I saw myself as running someone with good ideas who was proud to be those things. And a lot of people told me I should change my name when I first started running, that I should, you know, Suhas Subramaniam is not a name that'll win elections in a southern state like Virginia. But I wanted to embrace my name and embrace who I was, just come forward with who I am, but with good ideas. And I was really excited. You know, actually, there were other South Asians. There's two other South Asians running in the race too, in addition to like non-South Asians. And, you know, I ended up splitting the South Asian vote, but I won the white people and the black people and the other demographics in the district handily, because they just believed in me and they didn't care that my name was hard to pronounce. That some of them still probably can't pronounce my name, but they see me on the ballot and they vote for me. And so I think, you know, I feel proud when I see that there's people of all backgrounds and walks of life that come out and support each other. And, you know, it was really, really great when I was elected to see, certainly the Indian community was proud, but, you know, the non-Indian community was just as proud. And they're still just as supportive. And so I think that is, there's nothing more that makes me feel patriotic when I'm able to be me and who I am and be accepted for who I am.
Well, I feel proud that you will always get a proper Subramaniam pronunciation from my end. You know, this show will always pronounce Subramaniam very, very, very well. You know, now as we have more and more Indian Americans, South Asian Americans who are civically engaged and more engaged every day, do we run the risk sometimes of constantly kind of battling for the same seat at the table? And there is an element of cannibalism, you know, within the community where you're sort of like, well, I am running, and like it or not, there's some identity and identification politics that are involved. You know, at some point, the pride that you just mentioned, right? Is that a problem in our own community, particularly when, you know, we are trying to build coalitions and we are trying to actually come to middle ground, and at the same time, we're also trying to build donor bases as well for South Asians and Indian Americans. You know, are they just, I mean, it's great that they're faced with more choice, but yet does it also pose a problem when it comes to running a campaign?
Sure. I mean, you know, vote splitting is a real thing. I think if, you know, every time I've run for a new seat, there's been a South Asian and an Indian American specifically that's actually run for the same seat tried to run for the same seat at one point. And, you know, what I found was there's other seats where they're open seats. Sometimes the person even lives there, but they decide not to run. They decide they want to run in the race that I'm in. I don't know exactly. I can analyze it all day, but in the end, I try not to discourage people from running generally. I just try to be me, and people want to see me in office, they'll vote for me. And I think it's nothing but a good thing that South Asians and Indian Americans, and, you know, I want to see more Hindu Americans elected to Congress too, and elected to local office. I think it's nothing but a good thing to see more people running. And, you know, we're, you know, the long term, maybe, I think there's a lot of different movements that are starting to support candidates like me. Like I'm endorsed by a lot of like national Indian American groups because they feel like this is a good opportunity to pick up a seat in Congress. But, you know, long term, I think it's only going to be good for us, the more people that run.
Yeah, no, of course. You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's take a quick break and return to our conversation with congressional candidate Suhas Subramaniam. Stay tuned. Every story told is a lesson learned, and every lesson learned is a story waiting to be told. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Krish Ashok, author of Masala Lab, The Science of Indian Cooking, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tam France.
Hi, I'm Congressman Rao Khanna.
Hi, my name is Richa Morjani, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing with Abhay Dandekar.
Hi there, I'm Abhay Dandekar, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation now with Suhas Subramaniam. I want to get back to one thing. You said that if there's a tough issue out there, you get the straw, perhaps the short straw, when, you know, like, let's give this one to Suhas. So, I mean, tackling issues like price gouging and pharma companies that are perhaps really sticking it to consumers, gun safety, cybersecurity, energy bills for the middle class. With all these things that seemingly feel and seem so good, like great middle ground solutions and gifts in some way to the middle class. And yet voters are still always pulled into these tribes. Like you mentioned, like blue and red, you know, they're just constantly polarizing in some way. With your record of really fighting big fights, how do you draw attention for voters back to your record? Like you said, being you, you're just being who you are, and you're trying to make sure that you highlight and amplify some of the things that you've done. But how do voters feel compelled, you know, by that? What more needs to happen so that, you know, people, again, are not necessarily drawn to the tribalism out there, but more drawn to what's not necessarily so popular to get more likes and more eyeballs on screens?
It's a good question, and I don't have a good answer for you. The reality is it is incredibly difficult to get my message out there. And it's incredibly difficult. I sometimes will do really hard things, and it's hard for even people to know that I did them. It's hard for people, yeah. You know, they'll know the latest like political meme, but they won't know that, you know, we saved them $300 million across the state on their utility bill. They'll see the check and they won't know why. And, you know, so it's the one of the most difficult challenges in politics is, and I always tell people that policymaking can never be divorced from the political process. And even the way in which you go about getting the policy done, that process, they're all tied together. And you can try to pretend like the policymaking should be different, but it's not. Our politics dictates our policymaking. Again, I'm an optimist. I think that we will face challenging problems. Right now, it's divisiveness. It's trying to pass a budget without it being held hostage. It's trying to figure out really tough problems that aren't getting done because of gridlock. But I feel like we've risen to the challenge as a country in the past. And one way or another, we're going to overcome it and we're going to come out on top. So I believe in the future. And it starts by, I think, new leaders who come in committing to making change and committing to doing better because we have to.
One thing that strikes me about that is, you know, again, you mentioned the gridlock part and finding tough or great ways to tackle tough issues. And again, it is impossible sometimes to really share that message broadly so that people have it at top of mind. In thinking about what your experiences have been so far, both personally and professionally, and now getting that opportunity to possibly be in Congress, what are some of the things top of mind for you that in a way you've kind of had to unlearn about yourself or like maybe even just change the way you think, if at all, by the way, to sort of make progress happen?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I've learned and maybe tried to unlearn was you can't make everyone happy. And so if you try, you're just going to make everyone unhappy. And the only way you can come close is if you give them process, you give them a voice. And again, I go back to, you know, taking a gun violence prevention example. If you try to make everyone happy on that issue, a lot of people are not going to be happy. And so you have to start with what you think is the best for the community and what the community thinks is best for itself. And then you should just talk to both sides, even if one side doesn't agree with you. We have to have conversations with people that disagree with us, and we're not going to be able to make them happy. When I first started, I tried to reason with people, but in the end, the other thing I've learned is politics is not about reason and logic. It's also about emotion and policymaking too. And our policies reflect that. Some of our policies are not logical. If you think about it,
right.
And like an AI driven vehicle that is only gets to an accident once out of every 10,000 drives is much better than a human that gets going to crash once out of every 2,000, right? Statistically, right. It's better, but people are more scared of the AI driven vehicle.
Right.
And that's not logical, but that's the choice that that's how people feel. And you have to listen to how people feel. And sometimes even the people that disagree with you will make good points. So
have you, in a way, found yourself actually being tugged by emotions that you've been surprised by that haven't necessarily been the logical way that you would have thought about something in the past?
I mean, all the time. I mean, you know, we have bills every day where we don't know if it's the best policy, but the emotions of surrounding the bill makes us want to do something. I always have carried legislation to support first responders because, you know, volunteers of firefighter and EMT. And sometimes they, you know, we put forward bills that we probably can't really pay for, you know, trying to get benefits for certain cancer presumptions is very difficult. Trying to get benefits to 911 operators is a lot of money. And so I know we have to pay for our schools and I know we have to pay for so many other things, but I can't help but at least try to like see if we can scrounge some money for some of these folks because, you know, that there are firefighters dying of certain cancers because of their line of duty. It's emotion. I know it's not, you know, and usually my bills on that fail because we don't have the money, but it doesn't mean I don't try. But yeah, you know, sometimes emotion is, you know, very important, because I feel the pain of lost firefighters and EMTs in our community who maybe, you know, got cancer.
Yeah. And of course it's hard not to, in fact, pay equal attention to the storytelling and the emotions that are out there, so that, you know, in the end, we're trying to make progress and do good for each other. In a way, I've always said this, even on this program, that, you know, your vote is the ultimate showcase of trust in democracy and people who are going to hopefully represent you and lead the way when it comes to all of our sort of civic engagement. What's your formula, if you will, for, you know, cultivating trust? How do you empower, you know, trust in constituents and people who you build coalitions with and stakeholders? And most importantly, how do you cultivate trust in voters?
Yeah, I think the way I try to do it is I try to be responsive. I try to be a listener. I try to take action when action is needed. And I just try to do the best job possible, work really hard. And that's all I can do. The true answer is everyone's got a different litmus test when it comes to trust. There's some people who will never trust me, who will never trust any politician to do anything. So all I can do is just try to do better, be better, and take feedback. I don't get angry. People have called me all sorts of things. You know, I've gotten lots of angry calls, but you know, I always try to say, I feel you. I understand why you're upset, and you know, I'll try to do better if there's something that I did. And we don't agree on this one, but it doesn't mean I haven't listened. It doesn't mean I won't take your thoughts in mind.
Does your litmus sometimes in hearing both the calls for that are supportive and also the calls that are really, really not supportive and angry, does that ever test your trust in voters?
I don't know. The place that I represent, Northern Virginia, Loudoun County, Prince William County, probably with some of the smartest voters, I think, in the country. They're keyed into DC. They know federal politics well. They follow state politics more than the average person. So I tend to have a lot of trust in my voters, certainly. I've never had another job. I've never represented an area that's different than this one. But I actually trust the voters quite a bit on the issues because they live the problems that we're trying to solve, and they tend to have really good ideas. So, you know, I think I've never really had my trust in voters tested.
Yeah. Well, whether it's in the public sector, private sector, certainly doing the good work of representing your constituents and, you know, certainly helping to represent Indian Americans and South Asian Americans out there. Suhas, we're so grateful for all you're doing and wish you nothing but the best. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you. And for more info, please visit my website, suhasforvirginia.com. Thank you again for having me. And it was such a pleasure talking to you.
Again, that's suhasforvirginia.com. And don't forget to please register to vote and help get out the vote wherever you are. A big thank you for rating and reviewing and passing the word along to your friends and family about Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Please be fiercely kind to the planet and try and deliver a random act of kindness along the way. Till next time, I'm Abhay Dandekar.